Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics, one from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight, 454 for comics originally released on April 20th, 2016. Now, starting us in DC is Flash number 50. This is written by Van Jensen. We've got art by Jesus Moreno and Paul Pelletier, and a fair number of inkers, a couple of colorists. It's a pretty big team. It's an oversized issue. There's a main story here. There's a backup story. And I had kind of mixed feelings on this. I mean, overall, I liked it. It felt a little odd for an issue number 50, an oversized issue, to be kind of the middle of a story. And there were times where it felt like this was kind of teasing, you know, as much or more story than it was actually delivering on in some respects. But it was a solid story for a middle chapter type thing. The art was well done. There were a couple of things like who's kind of orchestrating this whole, you know, setup of the Flash, getting him arrested and all of that. The minute we kind of get the scene with the trickster and he's talking to the guy in shadow, it's like, ah, I know who that is. And I thought it was an interesting choice of a villain for a Flash story. But I actually had a harder time on the previous scene identifying who the guy in the boat was at first. Because we're at a point with DC right now where they're kind of re-embracing some of their past. We get a guy in a boat wearing a fishing hat and having a t-shirt with the kind of Golden Age Green Lantern emblem on it. And he bears just enough of a resemblance to the Jay Garrick character in classic comics that I'm like, that can't be Jay, is it? And sure enough, it wasn't, but that was one where I think they tried to either toss an Easter egg in or something, and it confused me a little. Now, have you been following along with this storyline, or you kind of coming
and going?
No, I
came in cold on this one.
How did it work for you?
I mean, it was good. I thought it was all right. I didn't feel lost or anything. They gave me enough exposition to kind of catch me up. And it was, I think the art was pretty strong, and I thought that the story was pretty good as well. It was a pretty good Flash story, all in all.
It was very enjoyable. It told what it needed to. I just didn't feel like it really leveraged the extra space it had. It felt like they could have tightened stuff up. It felt like it could have been a lot more impressive than it was, but it was still a very good comic. It's just, I guess I expected a little more out of an issue 50 or something. But I think they're also in an awkward position of trying to make a big deal out of these issue 50s, but we're only, you know, a few months away from Rebirth, so how much can they really change things up or do things, or you know what I mean?
Was this $5?
Yes. Yeah. And then that was part of it. For $4.99 cover price, I was expecting a little bit more than this. I mean, I liked what we got, but I wasn't as blown away as I could have been. And the fact that it ended on kind of a reveal and, but wait, there's more. Like, really, this is an issue 50. You know, is this storyline going to play out over the next two issues, just the next one? What are they going to do for the last issue? I was kind of confused about the big game plan here.
Yeah, because some of the other 50s, you know, there was some monumental things happening in them.
Mm-hmm.
And really well-told stories that, I mean, were really great issues. And this was good, but it definitely, I wouldn't call it great. And with the promise, which is not fair to this comic, but with the promise of towing the line at $2.99, you know, in the future and you know, just a few months away, all our comics are going to be $2.99 at DC. And to, you know, a $5 comic is a little tougher to swallow now, I think, because of that.
Although I
didn't like swallowing it before, but I really kind of don't now.
I don't know if all of them are going to be $2.99. I think the vast majority, certainly all the ones going twice monthly.
Right, right.
I guess for me, having read, again, Superman 50, Batman 50 and stuff, where some big stuff happened.
Those were the two I was thinking of, too.
This one, I mean, again, it was good, but it didn't have that level of extra oomph or whatever. And then, man, we hit the backup story, which is all about Wally West. And it was fine. It felt a little bit light.
Mm-hmm.
Who did the art on this? Let me see if I can find that. It reeked of, let's see, it was Joe Eisma who did the art. I thought it looked familiar from Morning Glories. But the backup feature just, it felt like they realized they needed to kind of rush the Kid Flash reveal before Rebirth. And it's like, well, I guess we'll do that here and now. And it just felt like they're building up, and then boom, here it is. We got to move on, you know. And even here, we don't really get him as Kid Flash. We just get the reveal that he's going to become Kid Flash. And it's like, we've known this for quite some time. It felt a little mishandled.
And it was just definitely two different tones in these two stories. And this was really, really light and very much geared towards an all ages audience. And where the other, the main story was a little darker in tone and a little more adult, I guess.
I wouldn't say that the main story was particularly dark or adult, but it was not as almost light or whimsical as the backup. So in comparison, certainly I agree with you.
Yeah.
But I don't want people thinking, oh, well, you know, it was a particularly dark or you know, gritty or whatever.
No, not in the grand scheme of dark and darker toned books out in the comics landscape now.
Yeah, but I do think the lead story was a little bit more substantial, had a little bit more depth to it than the backup, which was, again, a very kind of a light story. It too felt a little, I don't say decompressed, but relaxed pace while still rushing the Kid Flash storyline. It just seemed like either this whole creative team was caught short by Rebirth, or they just didn't have their timeline planned out well as to when they were going to do what. So, I mean, I liked the issue overall, but it does make me question the planning around, you know, how they do their arcs and that kind of a stuff, and maybe how quickly Rebirth may have, the trigger may have been pulled and said, okay, we're doing it now. Because it seemed like they were building up to some stuff that they just may not have time to tell before Rebirth, and it may be perfectly fine after. I don't know.
That's, yeah, I mean,
the shakeup that is.
The reveal was a fun one with who the villain was. I enjoyed that reveal, but it would have been a fun reveal in a normal everyday comic. To be a 50, with the fact that it seemed like we were celebrating something with some of the other 50s and really putting something behind them, it felt a little flat.
It felt more like an issue 49. I mean, seriously, 49 had ended the way this did with, aha, this is the bad guy. And then 50 was basically Flash turning his situation around from being arrested, being thrown in prison, to, okay, now he's regained the trust of the city, or, you know, whatever, he's back to being the hero. That could have been really cool. And then they could have spent 51 and 2 doing some stuff with Kid Flash and then go into Rebirth. But from what I'm seeing in the postcards that I've been getting in with my shipment at DCBS, the DC Universe Rebirth one, they've got Robin and Superboy and Kid Flash right next to them. And it's interesting because he's in the classic yellow and red Kid Flash outfit, whereas everything we're seeing here is the newer white and black Kid Flash outfit.
Now, this Superboy is the Superboy from Lois and Clark comic?
It has not been revealed, but that is my supposition. And it's
that kid's really an engaging character.
I hope it's that character. I think it's a great choice.
They don't introduce yet another one. I think that's perfectly good. Will. Yeah.
But it is kind of interesting seeing, you know, this Kid Flash starting to get introduced here, getting this postcard where we've got Robin, Superboy, and Kid Flash. And it just makes me wonder if a Young Justice series is in our future.
Yeah, I mean, Damian really is going to be kind of the old man of the group, isn't he?
I think Wally would be older than him, but Damian would be the more mature, more the leader, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I would imagine he would be the leader. I can't imagine him playing second fiddle.
Oh, me neither. Again, overall, I really enjoyed this issue. I thought it was good. It was not the big deal that I was hoping for out of an issue 50, but it was still a very enjoyable story. So for me, I'm going with a B. It again, you know, I like the Flash. This did not disappoint. It just didn't over. It didn't impress me and knock my socks off the way I was hoping for an issue 50.
I agree completely. I'm just a hair under that at a B minus. It's a good comic. It was $5. It didn't live up to my expectations of what a 50 might hold, but it was still an enjoyable read.
Well, and I think we're both in agreement that it didn't live up to what we would expect out of a $5 comic either.
Right.
So, all of that having been said, shall we move over to our Marvel comic?
Yes.
This is Howard the Duck number 6. This is part 2 of 2 of the Animal House crossover that started in Unbeatable Squirrel Girl number 6. Both that issue and this issue take place prior to the current volumes of these titles and after the previous volumes of these titles, as if that's not confusing enough. And I read the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl number 6 right before reading this issue of Howard the Duck number 6. We've got Chip Zdarsky and Ryan North as the writers, and Joe Quinones as a penciler, a handful of inkers. Are you reading Unbeatable Squirrel Girl?
Yeah, I do read that comic, and I dropped off of Howard the Duck, but I really enjoyed this issue, so I might think about giving it another try.
Okay, so this may be getting you back into this. Interesting.
This is probably doing exactly what these crossovers are supposed to do, you know, make you sample something else that maybe you're not reading because you are reading one of them. You sample the other, and maybe you stick around. And I thought this was really well done. A really good team up of creators and characters and a good mix of things. And it kept the what I like about Squirrel Girl, which, you know, if you would have told me I would be enjoying the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl about a year ago, I would have laughed in your face. But I do enjoy it. It's mm-hmm. it's clever and well done. And I like some of the extra touches that we get in each and every issue. It's a lot of fun. And this was a really good two-parter. And I thought was a kind of an absurd premise, but it worked for the characters and it worked for the universe that they live in. And it was wacky and fun.
Well, and I think this felt as much like a Squirrel Girl issue as it did a Howard the Duck and vice versa mm-hmm. with the Squirrel Girl number 6. If you're not reading Squirrel Girl, you're only reading Howard the Duck, and you're willing to just kind of jump into the middle of a story, I don't think you'll have any problems. I frankly didn't feel Unbeatable Squirrel Girl number 6 was essential reading for this crossover.
No.
You just have to realize, again, you've missed half the story, and just boom, we're starting at this point and going from there.
But you get a really nice recap from Howard on the first page, so that
helps.
Well,
and that's after the recap on the previously on page.
Mm-hmm. So just in case you skip those, though, they're going to reinsert it.
There was an aspect of Unbeatable Squirrel Girl number 6 where I just thought it was incredibly wordy, and there were some places in this issue of Howard the Duck where I kind of felt the same thing.
Inherently, Squirrel Girl is more wordy than most comics because they insert some subscript below each page, so you get a little extra reading that you don't have in a lot of other comics. So even if it's a sparse page, you still have, you know, a couple of lines that you're always going to get in addition. I think that does also add to it. It takes you a little longer to read these too because the print is so small.
Well, and even if you ignore the stuff at the bottom, there are a lot of these panels where people are doing some pretty major soliloquies.
They are. They're very long.
So, I mean, there's, like you said, the almost bonus material there at the bottom, but you know, some of the conversations she's having, Squirrel Girl's having with Craven and a few of the others or whatever.
Now, do you skip those?
Which?
The bottoms. The bottom text.
Often.
Do you really?
I'm an old man. My eyesight's not that good, and it's tiny print.
That's my favorite part of the book.
Sometimes I read them. Sometimes I don't. It depends. Sometimes I think they're mildly humorous. Rarely did I think they're just, oh my god, that's brilliant. But it's nice to have that there as additional mm-hmm. material. It shows they're putting a little more effort in, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sell these comics short. For me, they're palate cleansers. I don't have a lot of lighthearted fare in my comic reading. Sometimes it seems like it's just dark story after dark story, and it's a really nice change of pace. I think a lot of that has to do with my enjoyment of it too, because it's so unlike the other things that I'm reading.
And I think that's a good way to put it, because I like these for what they are, but I certainly wouldn't want all of my comics this way.
Exactly. I wouldn't read the International Squirrel Girl.
or the all-new, all-different, and uncanny Squirrel Girl.
Exactly. One title is enough. But Howard the Duck, kind of engaging. I think I might give him another try.
Yeah, I thought this did a good job kind of bridging the gap, and I think it could take somebody from one title to the other. I do think it also, and I think this is more of a Howard the Duck thing, but a little bit of Squirrel Girl, because both of them have the same sort of sensibility in a few respects. They are a little, I don't want to say disrespectful, but make fun of some of the guest characters that show up.
Yes, and they and some of the established Marvel characters as well. You know, Squirrel Girl always takes a shot at Iron Man, and Howard the Duck always seems to take a shot at Spider-Man.
Well, in this issue, Beast, an original X-Men, I felt was out of character both as an original X-Men and as a current X-Men, and I couldn't for the life of me tell you why he was continually pointing out he was an original X-Men.
He was treated horribly by the creative team, I thought, in this. And he was drawn really, really poorly.
Well, there was one or two panels where you didn't even get his face, because the story's not about him.
Yeah.
Much as he might disagree. You know, for me, I expect that sensibility out of these books, and I'm okay with that. I also think the approach with Weapon 2 was kind of funny.
Yeah, I liked him.
That was a very different take on the Weapon X program. I also found it funny when the person who's hunting all of these characters comes and attacks. She's got both Iron Man boot jets and Falcon wings. Like, really? She needs both?
But she also had a Hulk hand and a Captain America shield and a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah. So, but again, that was the gist of the character or whatever. I thought this was a decent crossover. If you like one of the titles, there's a good chance you'll like the other.
Yeah.
And
I understand it's absurd.
Yes.
And that this character is... This villain is ridiculous, and a lot of the characters are ridiculous, but it's fun.
It is, and I really commend the writers. I think they worked well together, and they had it didn't feel like one story was strictly Howard's perspective and the other issue was strictly, Squirrel Girl's perspective or something like that. It felt like they really blended the sensibilities of the two books, which I don't think is radically difficult, but they did it smoothly. And I think as a crossover goes, they really got the idea of the point of a crossover and executed on it pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought of the two as existing in the same space, and I feel stupid now because of how seamless I felt they crossed over. And they, of course they should be interacting because they exist in this place in the Marvel Universe that they're kind of the same type of characters almost. And yeah, I feel silly for not thinking this should have happened before because it was a really seamless crossover.
I also like the inclusion of Rocket Raccoon because I think his sensibility is a little...
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think what would be the right way to phrase it. But again, not taking it himself or the universe too seriously. You know, it fits with these characters.
And it was great Craven. A great Craven guest starring in both of them, really. And I really love the in Squirrel Girl, the Cray-Van, his 70s van that he had. Mm-hmm. Very, very funny. Some very funny sight gags in here.
Yeah, they do some good stuff. And I like how they can often have fun with the characters without being blatantly disrespectful. I mean, they certainly, I don't want to say take liberties, but poke some serious fun at these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I feel they go just a little over the edge where if they pull back a little, I might have enjoyed it more or whatever. But, again, they're doing some fun stuff.
Yeah. Some of the humor is, potty humor. Sometimes they just go for the easy laugh and you're thinking, oh, and you roll your eyes and move on. And then some of it's clever and, well-crafted. So I think there's good and bad in that. And if you can let that kind of silly humor roll off, you kind of get some gems in there as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's good. I think it's above average. It's a little bit more into the silly and that kind of a stuff at times than I don't say that I particularly care for, but it's not something that just wows me. It's like, okay, that was mildly funny. Okay, let's move on. Again, palate cleanser. It's nice to have this as a counterpoint to the overly dark, grim, and gritty titles that are offered in frankly too many other titles. So for me, this is a B minus. I'm glad they're doing both of these books. Squirrel Girl has been way more successful than I would have expected, and I kind of liked the art in this a little bit better than in her own book. It's nice to see this kind of more realistic take on the character visually. But it was a fun thing, and again, if you're reading one, it's worth checking out the crossing over issue of the other title.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good sample, a 1-2 sample of both titles. You get a good sense for what they're about. I liked it better than you did. I gave it a B+, and I think it was really a solid crossover. And it's the way I like my crossovers: short and to the point. They don't stretch on for months and months. You know, it's over. You got a good sense of each book, each character's book, and kind of their style, and you can make your judgment then. This is what I like. So, kudos, hats off.
Yeah, I will say, as far as how crossovers should be done, this is an excellent example. Again, short, to the point. Neither character felt like it was a victim of the other title to kind of bumping in and taking over the book or anything. And it's something that I think is got a good chance of being a successful storyline to get people that might like the other title, if they try the storyline out, to actually succeed and stay with the other title.
The creators seem to be having a lot of fun together, interacting and playing off of each other's characters. And I could see them trotting this out again and doing another 2 issues maybe next year.
I would be surprised if they don't. I think they should do it again.
And they could set it between volumes 2 and 3 when these inevitably reboot.
Almost certainly. Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
This is Department H from Dark Horse. Now, this is a title I did not pre-order. It had kind of fallen beneath it didn't really fall beneath my radar. I think it's one I just, it didn't look overly appealing to me enough to pre-order it. But you said, hey, let's try it out. I said, sure, why not?
Yeah.
It is done by Matt Kent. I think he does like everything on this. Since I didn't pre-order it, I did check out the issue through the press PDF copy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to let you go first on this one.
Well, what most appealing to me is Matt Kent did Mind Management, and mm-hmm. it was a favorite of mine. I really enjoyed it, and he did everything on that. And this feels like it could be almost a continuation of that. The main character in Mind Manage is Maru, and the main character in this is Mia. It's if you like Matt Kent, create your own stuff, you'll love this, because it is, if you like Mind Management, you'll love this, because it just felt like that without missing a beat. I think he brought his wife in to do the coloring on this. But other than that, it's all him. And this is an undersea whodunit, basically. And there's been a death in this undersea exploration lab, and she is brought in to investigate. And there's a couple of twists on her connections to some of the players. She's very connected to some of the players in the facility, as well as the victim as well. But she's there to investigate, find out if it was an accident, if it was nefarious. And that's about all we get. It's kind of just an introduction to her as a character, and to who the players are, who the suspects are. We kind of get introduced to all the suspects and kind of a little snapshot of who they are. And we meet the victim. And that's, it's kind of just setting the table for what this is going to be. Felt a little like Fuse, only she doesn't have a partner. But I've kind of got that sensibility from it as well.
You know,
we're going to solve a mystery here. And I don't know if we'll solve a mystery and that'll be the end of the series, or the first mystery in a series of mysteries. I'm not sure.
So I'm reading this. First thing, I open it up. Or not open up the PDF, and we get the page about here's how the wetsuit works or whatever. It's like, okay, I like this kind of behind the scenes stuff, whatever, that's cool. Odd to put it at front, but fine. And then we get Mia as she's about to go down to this underwater station. We get introduced to Q, whom at the very end we find out is the security, the muscle for the guys down there. And as I'm going kind of page by page, you know, it's like, okay, new world. I got some curious what's going on. I got some questions. You know, it's when we flash back to how she's getting recruited to go down there for UZR, however you would pronounce that acronym of the Underwater Science Exploration and Research.
I really hated that acronym. They should have dropped the A, and it should have just been user, because that it would make it so much easier to pronounce. You wouldn't have to stick the and in there, and it doesn't work, roll off the tongue.
No, it most certainly does not. Now, this is a government organization that's been overseeing Mia's father's work for over a century. Now, immediately, I'm starting to think, wait a sec, managing her father's work for over a century. How old is her dad? Figure he had to be 10, 20 before he really started, you know, working, or even 10. We'll say he was a child prodigy. Not that we have any reason to believe that. But it would then take a little bit for his work to be so groundbreaking that a government organization needs to be created to oversee his work. And that would take a little bit of time to go do, but they've been overseeing his stuff for over a century. And I'm like, at this point, I'm like, okay, I'm a little confused. This doesn't totally make sense to me. And then it's like, hey, okay, your dad's died. We're going to send you in to go figure out who did this. We think it was murder. Okay. First, she seems wildly detached and kind of unaffected by her father's death. Okay.
Yeah, I got a sense of that as well.
What qualifies her to go investigate her father's murder? I mean, sure, there's the personal connections that put her in a unique position. In other words, she knows everybody. That almost would seem to disqualify her in some respects. Is she a police officer, some sort of investigator? I mean, again, to me, what qualifications? Why send her down? This makes no sense to me. And then we get mentions of her space rockets and outer space. I mean, I guess she was an astronaut? It's not really clear from this. And then, if you go back to the first page for just a second, we get one line of dialogue from Q. They're getting into this submersible thing. He's like, we're sealed and ready. Okay, they're going down. Got it. He looks alien-ish. Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then, after the flashback, just about every time he speaks, he suddenly has this southern drawl, or at least that's how I took the phonetics of the dialogue. And I'll be honest, frankly, the font didn't help much either. It's pretty much a mixed case font, except there are only uppercase R's. And I'm like, is that to somehow emphasize the R's? What's going on with this? Could they just not get an R that worked? But, you know, teeks instead of takes and things like that. It's like, okay, they're going for a dialect here. I'm just not really getting it. It's not telling me anything about this clearly alien sort of a character. And not to say he's literally an alien, but I mean, I don't know what he is. We finally, after a break so they can refuel and whatever, and another flashback sequence where she meets, oh yes, her ex-lover who's going to be the communications officer. Gosh, how convenient. She literally knows everybody.
She knows everybody, yeah.
When we finally get out of there and down to the station, we get what I felt was almost a by-the-numbers tour of the thing, kind of cut short, but let's go through and introduce you to all the suspects. And we get to the names and kind of the positions and stuff, but we really don't get enough to understand, one, was her father just a horrible person that deserved death? I mean, what made him, you know, the victim of a murder? I never really got this out of this. And I never really got any sense of good motivation for any of these characters other than, well, they were down there. One of them must have done it. It just felt, in some cases, a little predictable. Oh, okay, we're getting to the station. Let's line up the suspects. And again, that's a common technique, so I'm not saying Matt Kent shouldn't have used it. It just felt a little transparent, a little convenient. And there were aspects of the setup in this issue that just raised a lot of kind of distracting questions in my mind that frankly could have been completely avoided if the setup had just been a little bit better. Not mention, oh, he's, you know, they've been overseeing her father's work for a century or whatever. You know, things like that didn't make the story work particularly well for me. You know, we've got a bunch of characters that just keep introduced. Oh, one of them's the brother, one of them's this. It's like, okay, great. The whole point of this issue seemed to be summed up best by the last page, where we've got a really nice splash page listing off all the characters, how she's related to them if she is, and, you know, a checkoff list for who you think done it. Even though there's, as far as I can tell, not really any particular major clues in this issue.
No, and I hope it is one of them. I hope he plays fair. I hope he includes a variation of this final splash page in issue two that has their who they are and these little descriptions, just as a reminder. I think that would be nice because there's a bunch of characters here. Tough to keep them straight, but this is very helpful. They're all very unique looking though, and so it shouldn't take long to differentiate between them all. And I think that would go a long way to do so. But yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. For me, I really liked the world that was being laid down for us. I thought she was pretty interesting, and I thought the mystery unraveled well enough to engage me and make me want to help solve it. And I can see where you saw some tropes and some crutches and things in there, but I thought it was well done.
Interesting.
I've killed John. What have I done?
No, it's one of those things that I didn't find the world. The world had aspects that I think could be interesting, but I wasn't interested in them. Part of it was the art style was not to my liking, but that's just how Matt Kent draws.
Yeah,
I knew that going in. That's pretty much a given or whatever. But I felt so much time was spent on things that, again, we don't know really much of anything about her father that would motivate somebody to kill him, or anything about these guys to these suspects to motivate why they would kill him. It just felt all set up, no payoff, not particularly great setup in my opinion. And it failed to really hook me. The lead character, I still don't know why she's down there investigating this.
No, I assume we'll find out, but maybe we should have found out in the first issue. It sounds like it really didn't work for you on a lot of levels.
It did not. It is something that, and again, part of it may just be the art was getting a little in the way for me. It failed to hook me. It raised the wrong questions in my mind in a distracting way. And I don't feel the need to come back for more. I really don't understand how or why this is going to be an ongoing series, much less a quote-unquote long-term ongoing series. They're not here just to tell, hey, here's her father, he was killed, here's who done it, we're done. Their plan is to just keep going with this. And if they can make it work, more power to them. I'm sure there's an audience out there for it. I just don't feel I'm part of that. For me, I'm going with a C minus. There's enough concepts there that could have been interesting, but just weren't fleshed out enough. There wasn't enough to make me feel I need to come back for more.
Yeah, I'm a little further away from you on this one. I'm at an A minus. It's really a great issue in my mind. Part of it is I'm half in the bag for Matt Kent already because of my experience with Mind Management and how much I love that and the familiarity I felt with this style and this storytelling felt very reminiscent. And I really like the watercolors. I like the art a lot. Two things that I think didn't work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I read a lot of indie comics, so I kind of overlook a lot of these jumps that you kind of have to take. You're like, well, I don't really know what that's about, but maybe we'll figure that out later. And
I'm okay with them leaving stuff for later, but when they introduce a couple of things that I think beg for an explanation of some sort.
Yeah. And I didn't beg for an explanation. Oh, they're sending her in. Okay. And I just accepted it on face value, and I didn't need to see her resume or figure out why exactly she was being chosen. And that's just the difference, I think, in what my expectations were.
A case could be made that a lot of what I'm questioning falls into the category of premise of the series versus, you know, the actual story itself. And I think if somebody were to call me on that, it's like, yeah, okay, that's fair. But I find the aspects of the premise so either confusing or it just doesn't make sense to me. that it's hard for me to accept that presence and that premise and get into the story.
You know, I didn't see that at all. I'd be curious to see someone, if other people that read this, if they feel confused or they got it. I'm curious. I'm curious to see
how
we can be that far apart.
Well, it seems like some of what you're basing this on is your experience with him on other titles and properties. And I don't really have that. I haven't read his other creator-owned works. I haven't read Mind Management, that kind of stuff. So I don't have that baggage to bring in. I'm not able to therefore go kind of on faith that, oh, yes, this will all make sense. He's got a track record in me. He doesn't have
right. Anything. Right. I guess more so as I embrace the art style.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not a problem. And I embrace the fact that he's an inventive creator and his worlds are kind of unique. I think they're kind of unique. So, it's just a different, I think it's just a different sensibility here between the two of us.
I think this is much more up your alley than it is mine. And there's nothing right or wrong about that. Different things for different people. That's part of what makes comics so great is there's stuff for everybody.
Did we review another Matt Kent where there was a spaceship and a group of people a while ago? Does that sound familiar to you at all?
Not off the top of my head. I'm not saying we didn't do it.
Yeah, I was because there was a sense of like when we the page with the suit.
Uh huh.
You know, kind of the breaking down the different elements of it. I remember a page in another book that we reviewed, an indie book, where there was like a spaceship that was a cutaway that showed the different levels and areas.
Castaways, maybe.
Castaways. That wasn't Kent, was it?
I don't think so.
Okay.
We've seen some other where they do some of that kind of stuff. For me, starting on that made it seem like that wetsuit or whatever was going to be particularly important or whatever.
And yeah.
It wasn't.
It wasn't at all. And, you know, it could have been a nice page at the end, a little B material. And you could almost have kicked this book off with that final splash page.
Maybe.
And said, you know, here's what happened and here are the players, here are the suspects, and then send her in.
Going to the H2D dive suit page for just a second, which again started the story off. The first thing it mentions is the built-in expandable speed release helmet with liquid and or traditional oxygen supply capabilities. Okay, I'm going to an underwater station and they're advertising that this is a quick release helmet kind of a thing. So I don't drown. Is there a risk of that? Why do I need this? Oh, there's quick-acting extreme pressure safety deploy, too. Well, wait a sec. How sturdy is this station I'm going to? There's quick-release fins built into the wetsuit boost. All this quick-release stuff seems a little panic-inducing, almost. So, I mean, it's a cool concept for the suit. It makes sense, whatever. It's just, again, those are some of the places my mind is going. Plus, the airstream propulsion system in backpack. Because the first thing I want to do with my air supply is kick it out the back for propulsion. I'd rather hang on to it to breathe, personally. again, different mindset. This is it's how I think, I guess. I'm sure there's going to be an audience for it. I'm sure they're going to love it, too.
Well, I don't know. Mind Management was barely cracking 4,000 there at the end, so I don't know what that audience is going to be. We'll see. Well,
and you get why they call it Department H.
Yeah, I thought that was clever.
Yeah. It was a little too subtle for me. It just took till now for me to get it. But depth. I'll give him points for cleverness. Alas, I've given my rating. It's too late. So I've talked for I don't know how long about how far behind I am on my comics.
It's been a lot of issues in a row, or a lot of episodes in a row.
No more, or at least not now. Maybe next week. Don't know. I am current.
Oh, wow.
I am caught up on all of my comics. I've still got a couple of trades, the One on Earth One, a few things like that. But, yeah, I've read everything from this week. I was surprised All New Hawkeye. Have you read that one?
No, I dropped that one.
Oh, okay. Well, it doesn't matter. It ended with issue 6. I'm like, already? Wow, that was fast. Bloodshot Reborn, number 12. Did you read that one?
Nope.
That one got a bit gory and just threw me right out of the story. I was shocked by how graphic one or two of the panels were and stuff. It's like, really? It didn't seem like what I would have expected. It wasn't what I expected from that title, flat out. Another solid issue of Astonishing Ant-Man. Enjoyed the Back to the Future issue. I really like this, the Captain America Sam Wilson, where we get the three guys who have been Cap and stuff teaming up. That was just fun stuff.
Yeah, the anniversary issue before I thought was really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really pleasantly surprised at that, and made me kind of want to read it some more. But my least favorite part of that issue was the Sam Wilson story. So I was like, maybe not. Maybe I'll wait until the other Cap launches.
I think a lot of what I was really enjoying about it was more the Steve Rogers stuff than the Sam Wilson stuff.
Yeah.
But I liked the interplay with those two and how Bucky was, I don't say acting as an intermediary there, but kind of the, hey, I've filled in for Steve too, so I know where you're coming from kind of a deal. There were some really good character moments in there.
A good 1-2 punch with Superman, Lois and Clark 7 and Superman Alien and American Alien 6. American Alien was probably not my favorite of the run so far, but it was still really good and really good Superman storytelling. And Lois and Clark continues to be one of my favorites.
Yeah, I think Lois and Clark is a great title. Again, I'm expecting that's the Superman we're probably going to wind up with in Rebirth, but that's just supposition. I'm hoping it is, because I think it'd be... I do and I don't hope it is. I hope it is, because I like his son, and I think his son would make a good Superboy, but I don't know how they could smoothly make that transition between Supermen. But, you know, we'll see in another couple of months.
It is going to be weird to lose one of them, and, you know, I know who I'm rooting for, but it's probably not the classic Superman.
Well, I'll be honest, I've lost track. Is this the pre-Crisis version or the pre-Flashpoint version in Lois and Clark?
Got me. He's a good Superman, though.
Yeah, he is. What else did we get this week? There's a ton of great stuff.
I didn't get a chance to crack that 80-page giant Legends of Tomorrow yet.
I did. That was one of the last two I read this week. I held off on that and one other just because it's like these may take a little time to read. In Legends of Tomorrow, I mean, there's four full-page stories.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised by the reveal teaser, whatever, at the end of the Metal Men stuff. It's like, has that character not shown up in the New 52 before? And I go back to with Sugar and Spike. I want their origin as PIs. Because the more I read it, the more I'd have to... I feel I almost need to go read the baby adventures of these characters. Because I'm not sure they're really in character. Spike just comes across as a little bit slow at times.
Mm-hmm.
And Sugar is just downright mean. It's like, what traumatic event did they hit at some point in their life to have them turn out this way? And again, I still wonder if DC is focusing more on kind of rebirthing characters than, you know, birthing new characters.
Yeah, you've got a lot of proof right there in your hands with that one. They had a chance to put some new characters in that book, and at least in one of the quarters of the book, they could have done that. And I'm surprised they didn't.
Well, and so far, I mean, name any title we're hearing about in Rebirth that. Other than the Superman that seems to really be focusing on a new character versus a derivative character. So it's interesting to see where they seem to be going and what they seem to not be focusing on. But you know, we've talked about that before.
One of the, we talked about how I really enjoyed the crossover between Squirrel Girl and Howard the Duck.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping to feel that same way about the Spider-Women Alpha crossover that kind of went across three books, and it's going to be wrapped up in just a couple of months, so it's kind of tidy, and I just haven't been able to get to enjoy it like I thought it had the potential to grab me and pull me back into all those books, and it feels like, you know, the Silk that I was reading doesn't feel like the Silk in the other books. It's almost like the other creators don't know how to write the other characters.
I know what you mean, because I have not, I've enjoyed the crossover, but I felt the Howard the Duck, Squirrel Girl crossover, both issues seem to be the dealing with the same characters, if you know what I mean. Whereas I get what you're saying about how across Silk, Spider-Woman and Spider-Gwen, the characters seem to shift a little.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I would have thought they would have written it together and would have had done a little, you know, at least known how each other's voice a little bit more, well, better than that.
Let's face it. With the extensive history of both Spider-Gwen and Silk,
How could you
possibly have read all of them? I think the writers all could have done a little bit more homework on the other characters. And if for something like that, it's worth baking in a little extra time just to circulate the scripts and have everybody read over and make sure, you know, have the Spider-Woman creative team say, okay, Jessica's in character or not. Have the Silk creative team, oh, let's tweak this just a little. This is how she would say it or what she would do. A little bit more coordination there.
Yeah, I mean, Silk gets over there to her, to this other world where her family could be alive,
mm-hmm.
and she could meet them. And she mentions this, and they the other two blow her off like it's the most ridiculous, stupid thing ever. Well, and it felt so insincere and not like I would think those characters don't seem that mean-spirited to me.
Jessica Drew seems to like Silk and Spider-Gwen. Gwen doesn't really seem to like Silk.
Yeah.
So I kind of got that aspect of it. It just, there are a lot of things to explain in terms of what's going on with the Silk character and the reveals and some of that stuff. It's fun. I hope it has payoff beyond just this storyline. But so far, while I'm enjoying it, it's not one that I'm clamoring for them to do this on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Whereas, again, the Howard and Squirrel Girl one, I thought would be worth repeating it at some point.
I felt Huck finished very well.
Yeah.
And another really strong finish for another Mark Millar series. I really enjoyed this.
I thought Uncanny Inhumans was really good. Continuing that, taking a story turn that I didn't see coming. And Titans Hunt number 7. Did you read that one?
No, I've dropped that one.
It was a 12-issue series that ends with issue 8, and that's another one where it's like build up, and wait, there's one issue left? How are they gonna, I mean, they haven't even gotten all the characters together yet. So I'm not as happy with that title as I was hoping to be.
So did you read the 30-some pages of prose that was the Lazarus source book?
They mentioned there were two books that I held off to the last. I did not read all 30 pages of text.
I couldn't get it. I couldn't do it. It
was... I came and went, but I was impressed by the source book. It had the level of depth I had expected out of Rucka on there. And it's just kind of mind-boggling how well he's thought out his worlds.
It is. It's an amazing tome that I'm not sure I'm going to read right away.
This, to me, is what differentiates writers from authors like Greg Rucka. I think he's going beyond just writing a script or telling a story or whatever. He's clearly built a solid world. And this is just how he seems to think from what I've seen at conventions and what I've read of his other work. He digs in. He makes sure his stuff, you know, is not necessarily airtight or whatever, but at least watertight as much as he can. Because he's thought it through and things stay consistent even if it evolves over time.
If every creator world were this rich and well thought out, I think we would not be as down on some of the average titles that we read.
Oh, absolutely.
I think they would be a whole class above with this sort of intelligence and craftsmanship behind a book. How could it not be good?
Well, to me, it also shows a huge passion and, again, taking it seriously or whatever. You know, if I were to have read the Overseeing for a Century line in a Greg Rucka book, I would know he had actually stopped, thought that through, and have kind of, I could ask him about it and he'd have a good answer. Now, I'm not saying Matt Kent wouldn't have a good answer, but I think the number of comic book worlds that I think are as well thought out, orchestrated, conceived, well crafted, as what we're seeing with Lazarus, I would put Astro City up there.
Yeah.
Beyond that, it starts, it would be hard for me to name some other worlds like that.
So folks hear us rave about Lazarus often, and you know, they walk into their comic shop and the most current Lazarus on the shelf is the Lazarus source book, and they pick this up, and several days later after they've finished it, does this pull them into this world, you think, and say, I'm going to go back to volume one and read it?
I think it depends on the nature of the person. If it is somebody who is, I'm going to go with like a role-playing game, pen and paper role-playing game type person who would love to read source books and things like that, this could absolutely do it. If it's somebody actually wanting a narrative and what they're getting is history, totally not. I think it's got the depth and the material, but if you haven't read Lazarus already, you don't have the context to care about this content. It would be like going to a bookstore and picking up a travel book on a country you're never going to visit and have no particular reason to go visit or incentive. You know what I mean? It's something that's just blatantly irrelevant. It's a book that was handed to you and said, you must read this travel book on, you know, Latveria or wherever. You know, it's, why would you care?
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like a Blu-ray extra, but I think it's just really well done. Really well done. And I just couldn't slog through it. There's too much there right now.
But I don't think it's one where he expects somebody to pick it up and read cover to cover.
It can sit right there on the shelf next to your other volumes, and it's a supplement.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what I love is it was the Carlyle stuff, and there could be another half dozen or more of these, one for each of the different families or whatnot.
Yeah.
So to me, I love that he's thought it out so thoroughly and in such a presentable fashion. I'm also curious
how much... And he's writing other books.
Yeah.
He's a busy guy, and he did this very meaty source book the mix with everything else.
How much of this is new material versus, say, what was in the letters pages and stuff in previous issues?
It feels like a lot more to me.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. I don't know. But this, to me, is what differentiates him. Not to say that other comic book writers don't work as hard. They just work in a different manner. I mean, there are some guys that are just churning out books all the time and doing really fun reads. But Rucka seems to, I don't say pick his shots more carefully or whatever, but really focus in, think through that world. And I don't know how much gestation time it took for Lazarus from idea to initial issue, but I imagine this was the kind of stuff he did during that time.
Yeah. Somebody like Grant Morrison, I think he has this sort of inventiveness and world building, but I don't think he writes it down. I think it's all just percolating it into his head until he writes a comic. And sometimes it all comes together brilliantly and sometimes it doesn't. But I think he thinks this way too. Really giant scope. And
I think he thinks along the scale, but not along these ways.
Yeah.
He's got the scope, but not the cohesiveness. And
I can't imagine a source book from him.
I would challenge him to write one.
Yeah.
And I think if he had, and enough of that stuff hit the page and then the narrative he was telling, you wouldn't have people feeling they needed to go research the story points he forgot to tell you. But, you know, again...
although Klaus is really great.
To me, Busick on Astro City, Rucka on Lazarus, there are a couple others out there that have just done some phenomenal work. That's head and shoulders above the rest. And that's not to say the rest is bad, but there's something to be said for somebody who's just telling a really fun Punisher story or Deadpool story or Batman or the X-Men or the Avengers, whatever. You don't need to thoroughly think out the entire world or whatever.
He's a major leaguer, and there's a lot of guys that are, you know, AAA ball, not ready to be called up yet, but they're, you know, and it just makes me just salivating for Wonder Woman. I can't wait to see him write that book again, and I think it's going to be great. I've got high expectations for what that's going to be.
Yeah, same here. Rucka's just a terrific writer. Preview Spotlight deadline, May 7th, Saturday morning. It's pretty much whenever I wake up and start working on it. I'd like to have all the clips. If you need a little extra time, just email me, let me know. But please post what you're going to send me and stuff on the forum so I can be kind of putting together my checklist. Last couple of months, we've had just an amazing turnout. I'm hoping for that again.
I might dupe one of your picks.
Hey, that's fine. Matter of fact, I think I duped a few people when I posted mine, because I went through the listings without looking at the forum, because I just wanted to see what appealed to me. And I'm okay with other people doing the clips on those items and me saying, yep, it's in there. It's a comic book page pick. We got a discount. I'm done. Saves time for me. But yeah, having everybody post on the forum what they're going to do and stuff like that just makes it easier for me to kind of put together my checklist so I don't accidentally miss somebody's clips or something.
Yeah, so previews comes out tomorrow, which will have already been out for a few days when you hear this.
Yeah, we're recording on the 26th. Previews comes out on the 27th. And again, the clips are due on May 7th.
But yeah, you know how it works. We had a really good turnout last time and want to continue that trend. I think you said last episode was the second highest after the 100th. So
yeah,
we can do better than that.
Hey, we had 70 some odd clips. It was about a 2-hour episode. I thought it was great. I added a couple of things to my list in the process.
It was an expensive episode for me, but it was still great.
It was a very expensive one for me. I ended up cutting a couple of items. It's like, you know what? This vendor loses out if they'd spaced their material better.
Did you get it under a grand?
Oh, yeah. I opted not to get the 112 collective stuff for the DC characters. The Marvel characters may lose out as well. At this point, I'm just sticking with the Star Trek stuff. If they had spaced out to like 2 a month versus like 5 that month, they might have gotten a lot more of my money. But they didn't, so they lose.
And in this, I think this previews is the first image insert, which will have a unreleased Walking Dead story in it. I'm really excited to see how they do their own book, their own catalog insert. I think that'll be fun and makes me a little more excited about having to pay for previews.
Are they also going to have the same section in previews as before or no?
I would imagine they'll have a page like Marvel does that just shows you a placeholder that image exists and there's the catalog.
In which case, for image, we'll do what we've done for Marvel and what we wound up doing last month for DC. Use the page number for your clip of that supplement.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, you're right. It'll have to be like I00 whatever, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And fortunately, I had changed my spreadsheet that I used to put together the show notes to handle such a thing. Since I had to do it for DC last time anyways, I kept it more generic than just that. So yeah, if for anything where they've got the supplements, we'll do that. But as long as I know clearly what the item is, I can go look up the page number and stuff.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. The DC previews, when we finally got it, was a lot more I thought it was more substantial than the PDF and had extra stuff in there. Didn't seem like it was an exact, maybe I got a bad link or something, but it didn't seem like it was the same stuff.
Okay. I'll be honest, I haven't flipped through it.
Oh. Which is
kind of funny because I already sent in my order. Been pressed for time lately. I've been catching up on my reading.
Yeah, we usually wait till the last day, so that's good. You're a day ahead.
Yeah, well, I got it in yesterday, the day before. Anything else? Are we pretty much done?
Nope, that'll do it.
Cool.
Join us next time as we discuss Batman number 51 from DC, Ultimates number 6 from Marvel, and Micronauts number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.